The Interchange is brought to you by Viking Cold Solutions. Long-duration energy storage, plus efficiency, plus resiliency, yes, yes, and yes. With Viking Cold's thermal storage systems, you can store and discharge up to 1 megawatt for up to 13 hours per day per facility, plus improve efficiency an average of 25%. Storing cold inside critical food supply infrastructure also provides 3 times longer resiliency during planned or unplanned power outages. See more benefits for the grid, food industry, and environment at vikingcold.com/grid. The Interchange is also brought to you by Nextracker, the world's leading solar tracking solutions company. Nextracker works with its customers to advance the connected power plant of the future with smart trackers, energy storage systems, and the TrueCapture advanced control software. Nextracker has more than 30 gigawatts of resilient and intelligent systems installed, delivered, and under fulfillment in hundreds of projects across 6 continents. Find out more at nextracker.com. That's nextracker.com. This is The Interchange, conversations on the future of energy from Green Tech Media. I'm Stephen Lacey, a contributing editor at GTM. Welcome to the show. This week, what can meal kits tell us about the energy intensity of the food system? When you get those meal kits delivered to your home, are they a net benefit to the environment, or are these time savers carbon heavy? I'm here with my co-host Shail Khan to tackle this meaty subject. Shail is managing director at the venture capital firm Energy Impact Partners. Hey, Shail.
Hey, Stephen.
You're constantly on the go, Shail. Do you ever use those kits with prepared food or portioned food you need to cook?
We have not yet. I keep meaning to sign up for a trial for one of them and then haven't done it. I've been told it's really, I mean, historically it was partially because I do travel a lot, but I've been told it's really easy to just turn them on and off whenever you want them. So it's somewhere in my future, perhaps pending the outcome of this conversation, but I haven't done it yet. How about you?
I have indeed. I've used a bunch of different services, like one vegan one, one vegetarian one, one where you cook meat. I've probably used most of the top meal delivery services. You know, I'm a new parent. I'm trying to run a podcast production company. I recently started using these meal kits to save myself time, but I started tearing open the packaging each week and it was really daunting. You know, there's so much styrofoam. There was a lot of paper. There's, of course, multiple boxes that it comes in. And so I was asking this question, how environmentally friendly is this, even though I'm ordering vegetarian meals? And I suspect a lot of people are asking that question because since 2012, there's been this huge surge in meal kit delivery options. You know, online buying and delivery is now the norm for all of us. There's a surge in interest in healthy eating. We're all insanely busy. And that's making meal kits like, you know, Home Chef and Blue Apron and HelloFresh a $5 billion business. So I was searching around for an answer to this question, and we found someone who can actually answer it for us. It is Dr. Isabella Gee. She is an engineer at the Weber Energy Group at the University of Texas. She actually did her thesis on this exact question, and she spends her time looking at the food system broadly. Dr. Gee joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin. Hi, Dr. Gee. How are you?
Hi, I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Good. We're talking specifically about meal kits, pre-portioned foods that you prepare. What are the things that you're looking at? What are the inputs?
So for meal kit delivery services, they mail pre-portioned ingredients with corresponding recipes directly to consumers' doorsteps. So within the meal kit itself, I'm looking at the food itself as well as the packaging coming from all the way from, you know, on the farm and the agricultural production of the ingredients all the way through to when it gets to a consumer's doorstep, and then also the packaging associated with the meal kit and the food waste that happens along the supply chain. Because, you know, meal kits make you think a lot about food waste at the home when you're preparing the food, but there's food waste along the whole supply chain as well, from farm waste to within transportation, retail level, and also at the home. So I'm kind of looking at the full supply chain with waste and packaging included.
So where do you start by answering that question? Like, how do you unpack a comparison between grocery store shopping and meal delivery? What exactly do you start comparing?
Well, I started with looking at food waste, figuring out where along the traditional kind of grocery shopping supply chain there is food waste, and then where in the meal kit sector there is food waste, and tried to compare for an individual meal at each stage, okay, what's the energy intensity of on the farm? What's the energy intensity of just a truck? Because not only are you getting a delivery, but also meal kits like to talk about their shorter supply chains. And so they go more directly from the farm to the fulfillment center.
Okay, so then what does the food waste look like for meal delivery? Obviously, there's less food waste, in theory, at your home when you have like smaller portions. They're prepackaged. I know I can speak by experience and say that I very rarely would waste food coming out of these kits. So what does that food waste piece look like deeper in the supply chain?
Well, deeper in the supply chain, food waste was broken into three different sectors: the on-the-farm food waste, or food waste from on the farm through that first leg of transportation to a distribution center or a wholesaler. And then there's food loss and waste at the retail level, so either your grocery store or your fulfillment center. And then there's consumer food loss and waste. So like you said, consumer food loss and waste is kind of easier to see. You know, you only get your two scallions instead of a whole bunch. You maybe don't overbuy the ingredients at the store. It's pretty easy not to waste a lot of food from the kits. But on farm is a little more complicated. There isn't as much information on farm food loss and waste. And it's also difficult to quantify because a lot of that waste on farm will be retilled into the soil. So does that really constitute waste? There's a lot of debate about that. But really, at the retail level, it was lower than grocery store food loss and waste. Not by that much, but because, you know, you're compounding all of the food loss and waste along the full supply chain at all the other levels, and retail is further down the supply chain, so there's been more energy used to get that food to the grocery store or the fulfillment center. It matters a little more. And meal kit fulfillment centers can waste less food potentially than grocery stores, because grocery stores have really thin margins. They're really motivated. You know, they don't want to waste food. That's wasting money. That's wasting their sales. They don't want to use a lot of unnecessary energy because that's also money. But they still have to deal with customers, and they have to have beautiful displays, and you want ambient temperatures for your consumers, but you also have refrigerated display cases, freezer doors opening and closing. So a lot of those energy efficiencies can add up. And then in fulfillment centers, you can kind of design more for just working on the food. You don't have to handle excess inventory for consumers. And you might be able, with subscription services, because you know the number of orders you need to fill ahead of time, more or less, you can kind of better match your supply and demand. And so the numbers that I found for meal kit fulfillment centers were maybe 6% food loss and waste around there. And these are a few years old when the businesses are still pretty new, whereas grocery store retail level food loss and waste is maybe more around 10%.
That's really good. 6% seems like a reasonable number. Is that still a high number?
I think when you compare it to the kind of national estimate of retail food loss and waste around 10 or 11%, I think it's a pretty good value. And again, those numbers are, at this point, a few years out of date, and these companies have been evolving at a rapid pace. And so I would not be surprised if those numbers were lower.
I'm wondering whether you think this is an appropriate heuristic. As you're describing the food waste part of this and the supply chain for meal kit deliveries, it's making me think about, you know, one of the many solutions that people have proposed for how to decarbonize agriculture is precision agriculture, basically just becoming more precise with how we do everything that we do on any given farmland, using better measurement and data and analytics and things like that. And for some reason, the phrase that's popping into my head here is precision food, which is just like, mm-hmm. the more that whoever's delivering us food, be it delivering us food in a grocery store or delivering us a meal kit at home, the more that they can be precise with the exact food that we need, the amount of ingredients that we need for that food, where exactly we're going to be located, how many of us there are, the more they're going to be able to reduce food waste throughout the supply chain. And so the meal kit delivery is like one step in that direction relative to a grocery store, but you could imagine in the future, you know, all of our groceries being ordered online and there being, you know, fewer grocery stores in the first place. And so is that like a path toward significant food waste reduction?
I think it could be part of the pathway toward significant waste reduction. the largest numbers of food loss and waste that we see, especially in the U.S., are at the home level, at the consumer level. The most energy carbon efficient method of food acquisition is I place my grocery order or my meal kit order ahead of time. I give them maybe a week to figure out the logistics of delivery to make sure that it's on the most optimized delivery route and time for when, you know, I'm home and I can get it. And having all of that advance notice has been shown to be the most energy efficient and carbon efficient way to get food, and also certainly to reduce that food waste because you can precisely order exactly what you need. However, it is, you can't, you know, if I say, oh, I want this ingredient just a week in advance, okay, well, that helps maybe the stores or the companies that are providing the food to know what they need to buy, but that food that you want had to be planted, I don't even know how many months ago. And the largest portion of the waste is still at the home. So I think potentially, you know, ordering online can help alleviate some of the stress on grocers or these meal kit companies, but also helping people meal plan better and saying, okay, well, I know exactly what I want to cook. I'm only going to order what I need. But there's also an interesting effect. There was one study that found that people are actually more likely to waste food that they buy online than they would be to waste the same food if they bought it themselves, because they don't have as much psychologic ownership over the food because they didn't pick it out. But I do think that online services and delivery will have an impact on food waste. I think we just don't necessarily know what it is yet.
Now let's get to a key finding that I was really curious about based on what happened to me. So I got these great meals. They were already made for me. I could put them in the fridge or the freezer, and my life was so convenient. But the packaging concerns actually outweighed the convenience for me, because I would open up this box. It would be a really heavy-duty box. It was lined with 5 pieces of styrofoam. They were big, chunky pieces of styrofoam. There was a lot of paper lined inside. And then the meals themselves were in these plastic containers that, as far as I could tell, were recyclable where I am in Boston. But, I mean, we know how broken the recycling system is. And a lot of these containers that get used for takeout food, these really thin plastics, are not easily recyclable. So for me, I just threw up my hands and said, I can't do this. You know, my trash bin was filling up faster, and I had these meals, and I stopped the service because of it. And you found that packaging actually makes up half of the emissions linked to meal kits. So this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah. Well, so I actually found that packaging makes up per meal half of the energy use associated with the meal. About, you know, for one meal kit meal, it's about 4 times the amount of energy for packaging than for the same meal made from groceries, which was very significant, because if that packaging wasn't considered, the meal kit meal used quite a bit less energy or required quite a bit less energy just for the food than the grocery shopping meal. But there are a couple buts to that. The first one was what I said: without packaging, you know, the meal kit meal, because it has such a lean supply chain compared to grocery shopping, the packaging is really kind of what tips it over the edge per meal. But then per week, the packaging is more comparable to the grocery shopping scenario, because, you know, meal kits only make up a few meals a week. So at max, if you're ordering it for a single person and you get 3 2-serving meals, that's maybe 6 meals out of your potentially 21 a week, right? And so the rest of your food has to be made up from the grocery store. So per meal, the impacts are a lot more significant than over the course of the week. And a lot of meal kit delivery companies, they've been making really big moves towards reducing the amount of packaging they use, or trying to work towards more sustainable alternatives. It's really tricky because, again, a lot of them are saying, oh, well, we're 100% recyclable packaging. But as you said, you know, recycling, we know, isn't necessarily always effective. And even so, some people might still just throw it out. Even if the packaging is compostable, throw it out, because I don't have compost. I don't know how to deal with that. And the packaging concerns are actually one of the major concerns that consumers do have, and a big barrier to entry for a lot of companies. But if you're using these services to replace those trips to the store, that actually might be able to compensate for the energy effects of having a lot of packaging.
Right. So the environmental benefits are very much predicated on trip substitution if we're reducing the amount of times that we're going to the grocery store per week. And if you're not reducing those weekly trips to the store, then the meal kit delivery just adds transportation, energy, and emissions.
Mm-hmm. I picked a kind of a general, what I thought would be a representative case study of someone. And in the case that I looked at, they're driving to the store. A store maybe a couple miles away from their house. But in reality, a lot of people that use these meal kit delivery services, you know, living in dense cities that have robust public transportation systems, or they maybe walk to the store. If you live in an area like that and you're getting these delivery services, okay, well, you're not replacing really a trip, energetically speaking. You're just adding a delivery trip. But the delivery services themselves might be extremely energy efficient. And that might seem, you know, counterintuitive because you have this big delivery van that maybe gets 6 to 10 miles per gallon of diesel driving, you know, 80, 90 miles a day on their route. But if you think about the energy it takes for just your meal kit on top out of all of the cargo that delivery van carries in a day, it's pretty low.
That reminds me a little bit of, there was some reporting, I think last week in Bloomberg, that Amazon at one point internally had considered the idea of offering a quote unquote green shipping option to customers. They ultimately decided not to do it for the time being, but it was some version of, you know, I accept slightly slower shipping time for some things that'll get shipped to me. But in exchange for that, you know, Amazon can be a little bit more deliberate about making sure that every delivery van is stocked up full, so that's making fewer trips back to the distribution center and stuff like that. And, you know, I know this is outside the scope of what you're looking at, but I wonder whether there's the possibility, as more and more things get delivered, including meal kits, to optimize it for minimal energy use or minimal emissions, and how much that would then make a difference relative to just, you know, shipping a bunch of stuff to a single grocery store and then having us all make individual trips.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting thought experiment and something I definitely thought about as well. I mean, I just read something from HelloFresh talking about how they have in a few places a dedicated delivery fleet of electric delivery vans, and they focus on optimizing the routes. I've also seen, when I looked at different delivery route densities, if you can spread out that one delivery trip over as many stops as possible, that's going to reduce that effective energy use and the effective emissions per parcel. But to really be able to do that, consumers have to be willing to let go of a little bit of control over the delivery window, right? And so, you know, we're kind of getting used to these, oh, next day deliveries, or I want them in 1 hour. You know, Instacart grocery delivery service sometimes has 2 hour delivery windows. And for a large delivery van that can deliver, you know, potentially hundreds of orders a day, maybe, being able to know ahead of time where their deliveries are and what they're delivering, they can fill up those vans and spread it out and make it much more energy efficient. But it ties into elements of choice and autonomy and last minute things, and it opens a whole can of worms.
We're going to pause briefly to talk about our sponsors. We're brought to you by Viking Cold Solutions. Long-duration thermal energy storage from Viking Cold is truly long-duration, with the added benefits of efficiency and resiliency. Commercial and industrial installations store and discharge up to 1 megawatt for 13 hours per day in a single facility, plus improve efficiency an average of 25%. By making real-time decisions and leveraging the unique thermodynamic properties of phase-change material, the Viking Cold Intelligence platform optimizes energy use in refrigerated warehouses, grocery store freezers, and restaurants around the globe. Thermal energy storage provides new demand management flexibility to electricity suppliers with a levelized cost of energy of less than 2 cents per kilowatt hour. Learn more about how thermal energy storage is benefiting the grid, the food industry, and the environment at vikingcold.com/grid. We're also brought to you by Nextracker, the global leader in intelligent solar tracker systems, software, and services. During the time it takes to listen to this show, Nextracker will have collected gigabytes of real-time operational and performance data from hundreds of thousands of sensors on its solar tracking systems and power plants around the globe. The TrueCapture Smart Tracker Control System offers additional intelligence and control that results in higher production yield and lower operations and maintenance costs, plus provides solar plant operators a valuable tool to protect their assets during hailstorms, hurricanes, heavy snow, and other extreme weather events. Find out more at nextracker.com. That's nextracker.com. So, Shale, you have been talking more these days about carbon transparency. And over the next decade, you think that products and companies and consumer behavior will be guided by carbon transparency. How does this fit into that thesis?
Yeah, I think this is actually a perfect example of it, but also a perfect example of why it's harder than I've made it out to sound, right? Which is, like, I think, you know, as new types of services and technologies take over in the market, I think that there is already and there will increasingly be demand from consumers to at least understand the impact of the choices that they're making on climate change. And then in an ideal world, to go beyond understanding the impact and to knowing what actions they can take to mitigate, right? So in this case, I do think that if it were exposed to everyone who is interested in ordering grocery delivery, going to the grocery store, or ordering meal kit delivery service, exactly what the embedded carbon emissions or energy consumption is of each of those choices, that would be valuable. And on the margins, at least, it would probably cause some changes in behavior. But I think what the research that we've been talking about is uncovering is that this is just one example of why it's actually a really hard question to answer, because it depends on these counterfactuals, like, am I avoiding a trip to the grocery store in order to do this? And that may or may not, that may make the difference in determining whether my meal kit delivery actually has lower embedded emissions than anything else. And so when there aren't these clear answers, I do think it, to some degree, calls into question the value of carbon transparency in the first place. But on the other hand, you know, there's a part of me that thinks, and I'm curious from both of you what you think about this too, more knowledge is better no matter what. Like, give me some sense of where the emissions are coming from, even just knowing that it's mostly in the packaging or it's mostly in the transportation or there's less food waste, but there's more packaging. Like, that stuff, to me, I think is interesting. And I think there are enough people out there that would maybe take some action based on it that it's worth trying to do in a broader swath of things that we purchase and do.
Well, personally, I would absolutely take action based on that. A few of these services do say, oh, we buy renewable energy, we're carbon neutral. You know, they're buying renewable energy credits and doing an accounting trick. But for the most part, few of them talk about environmental sustainability in a way that's attractive and meaningful. Isabella, what do you think about that? Where is the opportunity for them to do that? And is anyone doing it in a meaningful way?
I think that there are a lot of meal kit companies that are looking at sustainability in a meaningful way. I also think that as the millennial demographic gets a lot more purchasing power, they are really tied towards transparency and sustainability in their purchasing decisions. And so that puts pressure on companies that want to survive to cater to that. And I also think the companies that will be really successful will be ones that differentiate based on things like, we are the lowest carbon or the most sustainably minded from a dietary, from a supply chain, et cetera, consumer behavior standpoint, or ones that cater to specific dietary needs. I think companies, you know, like Purple Carrot is one that's all vegan, and they are smaller, but they're, you know, still around. And there are other companies that have, like, I don't even, like, 15 different diets you can pick from. But in terms of, you know, where these companies can make a bigger impact on sustainability, I think that they're doing a lot already with their supply chains. And given, you know, the scale of the audience they're trying to serve, the entire contiguous United States, that's a hard problem to solve given our existing grocery infrastructure. I think the biggest area and the most surprising one to me in terms of what consumers can do to interact with these services to become more sustainable is the transportation part. I think we all, you know, are aware that personal transportation is pretty energy intensive and carbon intensive, but really seeing it in the numbers the way that I did was like, oh, okay, I really, you know, I need to go to the grocery store that's closer to me, and I need to, you know, I should try to make that trip on the way home from work or on the way of my other errands, so I'm not just driving X many miles to the store and then back just for that. I personally, in terms of carbon transparency, I think that it would be really interesting. I know a lot of people that I've talked to are really interested in, you know, hearing where along the supply chain are the biggest impacts and what can I do and how does it compare? And so I think that both consumers and meal kit companies are really interested in how these services can drive sustainability in their daily lives and the food system as a whole further.
There is a pretty fierce debate going on right now. Maybe it's not even a debate. It's a change in perception about where we can make the most impact. And for so long, we focused on individual behaviors. And Shale and I did a show on this last year, and we looked at what individual behaviors do in terms of reducing your overall carbon impact in changing your diet and changing how you drive, in, you know, putting solar on your roof. And what we found and what a lot of researchers are finding is that you just need much broader structural change. Actually, a lot of the individual actions, of course, they amount to something meaningful, but you're not doing all that much. So I wonder how much of this is really the responsibility of the consumer to make those slight adjustments, whether or not I take two trips to the grocery store or one trip, and whether or not it really goes back on these companies to, you know, have a license to operate over the coming decades when we really need to make this huge push to do something about climate change and reduce our carbon intensity. How much of the onus is on them to make those major improvements and to keep going deeper?
I think a good deal of the onus is on them to continue to build out these sustainable solutions in the along the supply chain. I completely agree. I think that it's pretty easy to say, okay, well, let's put it on consumers, and most of the food loss and waste along the supply chain is at the consumer level. So it's not out of nowhere that we talk about individual habits and how that can have an impact. But supply chain matters a lot. And ultimately, consumers are just interacting with the existing supply chain infrastructure, the grocery and food system. It's so large. Ultimately, it can't just fall on the consumers, because consumers can only do so much when there's an existing monolithic infrastructure already in place.
Dr. Isabella Gee is a postdoctoral fellow with the Weber Energy Group, which is based out of the University of Texas at Austin. Isabella, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, well, that's going to do it. If you want to share your experiences or ask additional questions, you can find us all on Twitter. Shale Khan is my co-host. Ingrid Lobet is our senior editor. We are a production of Postscript Audio and Green Tech Media. Please send us any ideas for shows at postscriptaudio@gmail.com. And thank you so much for listening. I'm Stephen Lacey. This is The Interchange, conversations on the future of energy from Green Tech Media.